ready. It's time to forge the narrative.
Hey everybody, welcome to Forge Narrative. My name is Paul Murphy, your host. This is episode 183. I'm joined today by Andrew Whitaker and Justin Troop.
What up, homies?
I feel short.
And Chris Morgan.
The spice must flow.
Okay, I got to come right out of the gate with an apology. The last time we mentioned The Gathering Storm 3, as we were covering everything else, we mentioned that the characters couldn't be taken as part of armies of the Imperium. That is completely my fault. I just you get so excited and you skip things. But as we know, as soon as it was in everyone's hands, that is definitely not true. I'm not the only one that missed that, but that's still not excusing it. I apologize for that. Everything else we talked about and some of the combinations outside of that, 100% correct. So please forgive me and us.
We have done penance.
I do find it moderately amusing the way that Rowboat Gilligan, he can, because of the chapter tactic dynamic, right? I mean, he's the Lord Commander of the Imperium. They woke him up and they were like, get to work, right? And he's super upset. He's like, wow, actually, you guys kind of have not been doing a great job since I kind of died. But whatever the drama was, because of the chapter tactic rules, I was talking to a buddy of mine today who was like, if the White Scars call, nope, not going to help you. If the Imperial Fist call, nope, I can't help you because he can't be taken because of his chapter tactics in a detachment of Marines that aren't Ultramarines. And so, you guys talked last week about whether or not he could be taken in armies of the Imperium. Yeah, he absolutely can, except not Space Marines that aren't ultras. So if the salamanders come calling, sorry about it, Robo Gilligan's not going to help you out.
Well, we may talk a little bit about this later on in the show, but you've been playing Guard recently, and most of us like Guard. He works really well in a Guard army.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of list building theories that I've heard and that I've kind of discussed with my friends about. He's a great counter assault option. He's basically a giant, you come get some. I've got this.
You want my rapier batteries?
Exactly.
You want my cold dead hand.
Exactly. You want my thud guns? You want my field artillery? Why don't you walk over here and come get some?
Well, I am not prepared to relegate him to the backfield. I don't think he's also as slow as people think that he is because he's walking.
I think what Andrew is saying, though, is that he does that really well. Not necessarily that that's the only thing that he does, but he does that really well.
That's a fair point.
Absolutely, Chris hit the nail on the head. For my money, I am not I don't believe that Robo Gilligan is a worthwhile investment in point for in the main. In 75% of fielding situations, I don't think he's worth 350 points. I just don't. But he serves, he fills gaps, and he excels in certain roles. And what Chris just said is right on the money. I don't want to relegate him to a backfield counter assault option, but does he do that really, really well.
That's fair. I think the same reason you would take, some people may take a knight, or you may have a single counter assault unit. Now, you're not always spending that many points on a counter assault unit, but he definitely fills that purpose. And I think there's some camps out there of people that think he's too many points, and there are people that think he's too few points.
Yeah, I mean, you tend to expect that kind of response from people nowadays. You have the crowd that think that it's not good enough, or the crowd that think it's too good. Usually the crowd that thinks it's too good are a bunch of Tyranid players.
the people that have to pay fair points for things.
Exactly. And I love you guys.
Yeah, me too. I mean, crap. We all do that. We all have armies.
And we love the orcs. We feel for them. But I think that for what he can do, he's probably a relatively fairly points costed. That is my honest opinion.
There's no doubt about that he's fair costed. I think people had higher expectations and they wanted him to be some 600 point Magnus and they wanted him to be at the Magnus level. Yes, I'm saying Magnus is better than Robo Gilligan. That's a fact. Magnus is probably five times better than
Robot Gilligan. Globotron.
Yeah. But
I'm going to get my list out.
I really think that's the stigma though, is they wanted him to be more. They wanted him to be better and they wanted him to be 600 points and have maybe seven wounds and seven toughness and run 12 inches and all this other crap, but he doesn't have it. And 3 points, 350 points, honestly, I feel like he's a steal.
There are plenty of good uses for him and things like that, and I don't want to be the naysayer.
Well, this is a guy, dude, Andrew, this is a guy you can actually form an opinion about, and I think that you're going to find people that agree with you 100%, and then you'll find some staunch detractors of whatever that opinion is.
I think he's absolutely not worth 350 points.
In case anybody was wondering if Andrew was okay, because because he hadn't made any bombastic statements.
Yeah, exactly.
He is just fine.
I've been gone for 3 weeks, guys. I'm back, you know? Absolutely. I think that he is a really fun, fluffy option that could be good in kind of niche armies. But in the main, if you're a Space Marine player and you're thinking to yourself, I want to build a super optimized competitive Space Marine list, you're not dropping 350 smacks on this guy, right? I don't think.
Man, I don't know. I think in a Gladius, he's strong. And
where are you finding 350 points in a Gladius?
I'll find it. If I have to like stack rhinos on top of each other to get this dude into combat, I'm happy to do it.
That's exactly my point. If you put him on the back, if you deploy him 12 inches into a deployment zone, it takes him 5 turns to get to my board.
That is not true.
It is. It is. Moves 6 inches a turn.
No, he doesn't. He doesn't move just 6 inches a turn.
He can run. He's got fleet.
He has fleet. He runs. He has command traits. If you take him as the warlord, that add to his movement. There are ways. But we're not going to debate him on this episode. But I think that you are representing, that opinion is representing a good portion of folks out there. And I'll take the, and I'm not even like taking just an oppositional stance. I think that he has value and is not only just fun to use, but he has power. If you get him into combat, and it's not as hard as people think it is, that he is going to be able to really deliver a lot of pain, as we've mentioned before. But that's not what I want to talk about this year.
Perfect. And anecdotal evidence aside, I mean, I think that there's lots to discuss about him.
Well, I also want to see, I want to hear people's best list. I want to hear what did they come up with. Is running him with 40 Wolfkin as a bubble wrap, is that the way to do it? Are people, you know, anyway, I want to hear some people's ideas on how they're using him, or things that worked and didn't work, because this is a model that people want to work. And so there's going to be a lot of attention and focus on getting him to work. So we know this week, Games Workshop is at Gamma, which is a big trade convention. It's currently in Vegas. I think next year they're moving it to Reno. So, you know, if this is the kind of thing, you have to be a retailer or a distributor or something to get in. I don't know all the details, obviously, because I'm not one. We have gotten some information and some picks from the company altogether. They have owned this rumor source here. I mean, you know, the leaks and the rumors, it's very cool to see that happening. But we got 3 big drops this week. One of them, I think we know the least about, is the new Age of Sigmar release. That all we know is that it's going to be a box set that has a focus on matched play and otherwise some kind of organized play. What's the name of that one? Shadowspire?
Yeah, I believe it's Shadowspire. And specifically, in the announcement article they put at WarhammerCommunity.com, they said it was geared towards more competitive players.
So we don't know much about that. Later this year.
Cryptic much?
Hey, it's good stuff.
Based on what it kind of looks like in you know, theory here, it looks like this is an attempt at an affinity type scale, real small skirmish scale. I think it looks a little more focused on heroes. Maybe more time, like a twist on that, possibly. We don't know. Nobody knows right now, but the theories are out there. There's so much speculation, and it looks exciting because the artwork is, of course, amazing.
The next thing we got was the Armageddon game. What's the full name of that one? Shadow War Armageddon. This thing, now it's obviously got Blood Angel Scouts on the cover and orcs. So that has me interested right there. But then right on the, without even letting us speculate, it's not a Lost Patrol Volume 2. This is, they say come out, this is like Necromunda. There's going to be rules for 12 factions in the box. Some sweet terrain. I already know I'm going to need 3 or 4 sets of that terrain. It has cool Mechanicum pieces. The thing looks
amazing. Yeah, it's got a freaking Skulltula.
Yes.
Like there is a spider skull descending from the wall. Like, I want to paint it gold and pretend that if it gets killed, that I'm helping free a family from a curse. That's, and all of you nerds out there,
an amulet,
know what I'm talking about.
A medallion, like Flava Flav, with like 6 of those. I need that. And more importantly, back when Necromunda was, when it first came out, my entire group played it. I mean, you could use your 40K models. You built them up like little heroes. I mean, of course, you had some scrubs, you know, but you could still put personality into every single one. And it's not just like Blood Bowl, where, you know, you get it's different than that. You're able to equip them, give them certain war gear, they get skills, and it's like a hybrid between Blood Bowl being, I think, one of the most, not, I hate to say basic because it's such a just a phenomenal game. So it's the best one-off game I think Games Workshop has ever made, but it's like a bridge between the full-on 40K side and something like Blood Bowl side is what Necromunda was. And if we get that similar rules and concept in a game that allows for all the cool new, it's not just a reskin, it actually allows for all the new cool new models, then, I mean, we're cooking with gas.
My gaming group, everyone just lost their minds. And these guys have been playing since I was like, you know, 4, right? And they all just lost their minds, like, Necromunda is coming back! And they were just so ecstatic and over the moon, and it took over chat. But in terms of nostalgia, they had me convinced that it was great, great fun, and it's a pretty exciting release for anybody who's been invested in 40K for a long time.
You know, we've seen these pictures where it's not, they're not messing around. They're not teasing us with the factions. I think there's going to be full on. I mean, we saw, you know, stuff coming out, leaking out from the trade show of a full on support for the things that they mention on their own pages. And I think this is, I mean, again, it's going to be cool. I'm really excited about it. And so that's the second thing. The third thing, squats. We got a full on squat release.
Boom.
Not the first to say it. Of course, everybody who saw it, can I just tell you guys how excited I am about this fact? This may actually make me go Sigmar.
Okay, so obviously we're kidding. It's not a squat release. It is an Age of Sigmar release for the dwarves. I mean, what are they called?
Caradhran Overlords.
The Caradhran Overlords. They're all fully armored. It looks kind of like steampunk types. I mean, it's not steampunk in the sense of old played out steampunk from 10 years ago. It's more of a, I think, a modern interpretation of fantasy steampunk. And I believe,
ain't no monocles here, buddy.
Well, there is. No, there is. There is monocles.
And top hats.
And top hats. Right. And hot air balloons.
I love it.
But it's all metal.
It is. It
like
is.
Every inch of their bodies down to the beards are covered in metal.
You know, and there's, and I, Chris, I think that you, it might have been you, Justin, it might have been you on our Facebook page, Forge Narrative, facebook.com/ForgeNarrative, where you mentioned that this looks different for a reason. Like they want, from what it looks like, they want Age of Sigmar to have its own unique feel apart from even other fantasy games. This is original. This is unique. This is very fresh.
Exactly. And that, yeah, I was having this conversation with a couple different people, both on our page and in private. Basically, like there's people who really like this and people who really don't. People that really don't fall into the camp of, they don't look like fantasy dwarves anymore. And I think that's kind of the point. They have a fantasy dwarf range. It's Lord of the Rings. Lord of the Rings is the origin of most modern interpretations of fantasy anyways. This is their way of creating dwarfs according to their own story, their own branding. Let's be honest, it's something that they can copyright and sell, but at the same time,
Fire Slayers too, though.
Yeah, it's distinct. You can't forget them. No, and I haven't, but the Fire Slayers are also a lot different than the old Slayers in the sense
they have a unique look to them also. I mean, they're...
Yes.
And that's been they've been a staple in the Games Workshop Dwarf range for a long time. They're very popular, Fire Slayers, and now this is something that's a pretty big departure from some of that stuff. Now, obviously, the wrought metal stuff and big oversized weapons compared to the height of the figures and stuff is different. But, you know, these guys look to be almost like a real shooty type, you know, I want to say like old school Nuln Empire type army. I mean, that's what these guys look like to me with their weaponry, with their ability to fire. We know nothing of the rules, only what the figures look like and what they're armed with.
Well, that was the first thing. The Dishonored video game. Did you get that vibe at all, Paul? Just a little bit.
Now that you say it, I do get a little bit of that.
The whole long range concept was the first thing that kind of drug me in. For a long time, I've been talking about how I'm kind of a little bit sick of combat and melee assaulting and all that. So I want a shooting army, but I don't want to play it in 40K. And so I do play Sigmar, and I play the Sigmarines, and they're well known as a shooting army with their archers and stuff like that. But, you know, more often than not, their mortal wounds are being dealt via combat. These guys, you know, we don't have rules like, you know, like we've said or anything, but they look to be 100% focused on shooting, and they might be able to punch you in the face if they have to.
I mean, I see some big hammers. I see some harpoons, which I can only imagine are good for spearing large creatures. But I also see some big cannons. Now, one of the things that I had heard through the grapevine was that there was some kind of golem or something coming down with the dwarves. I don't see anything like that here, and it doesn't really feel like that would fit in with this aesthetic. So that kind of makes me sad.
I don't know. I could see it. I could see that being in there.
Like a stone golem kind of thing.
Yeah. It makes me think of kind of the Dragon Age sort of golem creatures that they had on there, where the, you know, with the runes carved into them and all that.
This Overlord Flyer looks awesome. Now, look, I'm typically against figures being on figures that I have to paint. But I'm totally for this model. I mean,
are you talking about the Baron Harkonnen?
No. I'm talking about the one, like, it's the big airship with the three.
Oh, the big airship.
Yeah, blimps that has a bunch of the other, whatever I'm going to call them, dwarves, with a bunch of the other dwarves on there crewing it. So the crew of the main, of the awesome figure, you know, this, it can truly be a centerpeece model.
Yeah, no, I am sold. Yeah,
the whole range is
the only thing I need is the ability, and I will pull that trigger.
Well,
I'm very excited.
I challenge another local buddy. We're going to have a Sigmar challenge starting about the middle of April and going until about the middle of May to build a complete and total Sigmar army and play a game by the middle of May.
So I like that.
Yeah. Anybody else wants to join me in that? Let me know. Let me know your progress. That's the kind of thing that helps keeps us all inspired and working on this stuff.
Well, one of the other things too that we haven't really got to touch on about this is, you know, we're talking about how cool they look and stuff like that. All their stuff that's flying is flying via metal balloons. So I'm curious to see what is driving this. You know, like is this steam powered? Is
metal
this
balloons, man?
You know what I'm saying? Like, what kind of, like, cool technology do these guys possess, or maybe even magic? We don't know, right? But it's so exciting to see this gigantic plethora of knowledge that's about to come towards us via lore that is for everything new. Like, all these guys, new name characters, new faction, new rules, new lore. Where do they come from? Who do they hate? Who do they like? This is going to be extremely exciting. And on top of that, we might see a few trees get cut down, because let me tell you, those things are a little bit powerful. It's a little ridiculous. And
well,
I'm glad.
Well, they're a beautiful army, and so they're. But it's the game. It was the first army book, and I'm not trying to, like, overly promote Sigmar here. Obviously, this is a 40K show, but Sigmar doesn't have the quite barrier to entry that 40K does. The General's Handbook, the one that organizes match play, they've got that priced pretty competitively. And then the pages of the rule book is only 4 pages long, and it comes in the battle. It came in my Sylvaneth battle tome.
Yeah. Oh yeah, the 4 pages are in almost everything. The actual core rule set that you need. You do need the General's Handbook, and it's $20-$25. It's an awesome deal. But you know, you'll find that in just about everything that you buy is going to have the 4 pages in there. So you can actually just start rolling dice with just a couple models in a lot of cases.
I love it. It's really nice to see them fully committed, because, I mean, in this range, we've said it before, and I'll say it again, and we're probably going to be impressed. Look, I love figures. I love the way the Games Workshop style. I mean, it's something that other companies try to aspire to. We're going to talk about some other companies' beautiful models after the break, if we're able to take one this show. So, you know, it's really nice to see all this stuff coming up, but it's hard to beat the GW style of things, and they have. It's twice the awesomeness with this release.
Somebody better go find Andrew. He's been way suspiciously quiet.
He's brewing some counter opinion, I'm sure.
You guys are talking about Sigmar, so I'm like, you know, yeah, awesome. I support everything you guys are saying.
You might want to familiarize yourself with the rules. That's all I'm saying.
just strap in.
Yeah. Take 5 minutes, read all 4 pages. You'll be good.
Now everyone knows everything we know about these models. They look great. You can expect a battle tome. The rules for the base game are going to probably be in the battle tome. That's what they've done in the Sylvaneth. I only imagine that's the way for the Stormcast Eternals. And, you know, if you're just a hobbyer, these models are going to make amazing centerpieces. And you now know everything we know. So right around the corner is Adepticon. Now I'm going to be there, and I've been building this giant display board. If you are a member of the Kitbash crew on Facebook, you've seen some of the stuff. And if you follow me on Twitter, @Warmaster_TPM, you will also see my work in progress shots. a buddy of mine came over and put his entire Alpha Legion army on here for display. They just got painted by a local guy. And so, it stood up. It stood the test of having an army on it, so I'm pretty good. But I don't want to talk about it too much, even though I'm very proud of it. And, my team trusted me to build it and come together and everyone be happy with it. Makes me happy. But a couple years ago when I did another one, I learned to make my own wash. Like, I made a wash because, you don't want to get 4,700 pots of Devlin mud. Or now Agrax Earthshade, and go to work on a giant display. Had to find another solution. I made something then. I didn't use that this time, but what I learned, the new tip that I learned, because you try to learn something new every time, is I discovered this product called, I didn't discover the product. I discovered its use for this, called Quick Seal Plus. It's a DAP product. I am not sure what this is used for. I'm reading it now. Kitchen and bath adhesive caulk.
Boom.
I ordered off Amazon. It came with the quick seal and all the tools, the caulking tools. And it wasn't very expensive. And I didn't use, I still have 98% of this tube left. But it's paintable. Permanently flexible, not having to use that part. But waterproof and paintable and easy water cleanup. And then the crack-proof guarantee. And so far, it's held up. Like, the premise behind this is that I put a bunch of Games Workshop kits together. And when you're trying to put them in patterns that they aren't designed to go together, you're going to get some gaps in between edges of the pieces. So I wanted something that I could easily work with. And this was perfect. This absolutely did everything I needed it to do. I had a glove on, but I was able to smooth out things with my finger and the tools. And when it was, even if it did dry, I could kind of just rub it off. I didn't have to sand it off, and so it didn't disrupt any of the surfaces on the models. And when I painted it, I defy anyone to come and find the places that I have all this seal. And believe me, it's a lot of places.
Challenge accepted.
Yeah. That's a glowing endorsement. I know gap filling is actually a really important and tedious part, especially for the Kit Bash crews. Whether you're just converting kind of basic level miniatures, or if you're doing terrain on the scale that Paul is for his display board, gaps are a part of life. Especially for me, I have been living that life for the last year and a half doing all these metal miniatures. There's gaps on gaps on gaps on gaps, especially in conversion work. So that's a glowing review for a product that you say that you feel comfortable with and saying, hey, you know what? I challenge you to find the gaps. That's a great product.
You might find a couple of them, but I promise you will not find the sheer amount. that's what my actual challenge is.
Even if you find a couple of them, that's not for – I would say me, Paul, everyone on the show is probably in the upper, we'll call it 70th plus percentile percentage of painters. We're still not Golden Demon winners, but we're above tabletop quality. And if you're in that range, you just want it to have it look good upon
somebody to walk by and go, yeah, somebody put some effort into this.
Wow, that looks really great. And if you pick my model up and closely inspect it and pour over every inch of it, yeah, okay, you'll find the flaws. I get it. I'm not Fabio or, XYZ Golden Demon winner. I'm not Adam Abramowitz. I'm not two-time GT Best Painted winner. Fair enough. I don't want you to fine-tooth comb my stuff. But if you look at it, I don't want to have gaps apparent. And so to have a product that kind of fills that the way Paul described is really nice.
I don't know if I'd use this for a minute, like a figure. But for the large scale stuff, this worked perfectly. And for the price, it wasn't this is stuff, anything you can get that's not designed like a specific hobby product. Like if I went out and bought, I don't even know what the size is. If I went out and bought 5.5 fluid ounces of hobby sealer, this might have been $100. But the tools and the whole tube, which I used again, a very small amount of, it might have been $12, and that's tools included.
Well, one thing I want to point out that I kind of liked, as you were describing the product, one of the words that stood out was flexible, and you're using it to assemble a gigantic display board. And, so people like me at conventions who have a little bit of a girth to them, they bump into stuff. I like the flexibility in the gaps here because I think it might save your model in the long run, too. I think it's giving it a little bit of a durability factor, which might actually play out. So, after you get back from Adepticon, let me know how many butts touched it and if it's still standing.
I can do that. And this is one of those things to where I used about seven different types of adhesive on it. So you learn as you go. If anyone is building something like this and is unsure of where to start, I think I now have the ability to at least translate how I would go about doing it, how I would do it differently the next time. Happy to share that knowledge if anyone is undertaking something similar. Another hobby thing to report, I am a firm believer in the Retributor Armor Gold. Everyone swore by that product and said it was awesome, and it has worked out also really well. So,
solid.
Yeah. I haven't tried the spray yet, but the actual paint in the pot worked great. I was painting some Sisters of Silence. Thankfully, Andrew came to my rescue and has let me borrow some of his.
I think that's the realest conversation Paul Murphy and Andrew Whitaker have ever had. We like made deep eye contact and we just totally agreed that building and painting Sisters of Silence is a fate worse than death. And we were just like, oh my God. He was like, dude, they were a total... unpleasant.
Well,
I'm not, you know,
light,
it's a family
and
show.
They're sleek, you know, and they have very small joins.
The surface area in which you can connect the model is terrible. It doesn't really, it's not intuitive where the, for example, the shoulder pads, how they
That's
fit
the
onto the arm
right
slash torso. It's not intuitive. Where does it stop? Where does it connect? You can't really tell. Everything, there's very tiny little fiddly bits, not only just like cleaning them off the sprue, but then getting them joined. It was a chore to build and paint those models. And they're still not done. I gave Paul, they're probably like a 80% solution, but you know, they've got six colors and are pretty quality from a tabletop perspective. But it was funny. I could see the relief on your face when I gave them to you. You were like, yes, you just saved me a ton of heartache.
I did not have to go and spend the next 3 days painting these jokers. But I'm very excited. I'm going to do my best to get a lot of audio from the convention, and I will try to make sure it is with exciting folks. And so check back, you know, if you don't listen all the time, you're not subscribed, then you're going to want to make sure that you come back in the next coming weeks, because I'm going to try to have a lot of unique content from some of the top distributors and design folks at Adepticon.
Well, Paul, there's a good chance you could get in with the 40K guys and Warhammer community team, Warhammer TV team. I know they're going to be there. Duncan Rhodes is going to be there. You've got, I mean, just for the sake of everybody, you've got to at least get a little spot from Duncan to say.
I don't know if I could talk to him. I mean, I would probably just get all kind of like Twitter pated.
I will pay you $10,000 if you can pluck three of his hairs and bring them to me.
Like Galadriel.
Duncan could have a solid side business where he just like sells brushes made out of his own hair. Like, you know, just like, I think that'd be a solid side business.
I was going to say this got creepy, but then I was immediately on board with this whole process. So,
as if any of us wouldn't buy that. Yeah.
Right? It's like, this is Duncan Rhodes. Apply two thin coats and keep listening to Forge a Narrative or something.
I would put him in my pocket and keep him.
Yeah. I basically tell myself, like, whenever I kind of get amped up to record the show, you know, you give your pregame prep talk to yourself, and I'm like, Duncan could be listening. And I just, that's how I get myself prepped.
Hey, that's fair. We all need to do that. Just take a moment of just thinking that right there to get us through. Let's take a quick break. We're going to come back, and I want to mention something that's totally unrelated, because there's a big thing dropped I think a lot of people are going to be excited about from Cool Mini or Not, and I want to talk about that very briefly as well. So anyway, we're going to hold tight, come back, talk a little bit about that, more about some 40K stuff, and then I have something to talk about for Vanishing Moves.
Love it.
Sweet.
See you in a minute.
You're listening to Forge the Narrative.
Hey, everybody, we are back. I'm still Paul with the Battle of Lost Souls podcast. I got Andrew Whitaker and Justin Troop.
What up?
Here.
Chris Morgan.
Shai Hulud.
So we know that we're going to get tons of gaming news coming out of Gamma. That's what it's for. It's a big industry convention, and you know, get our ears to the ground and all the sites and double clicking everything we possibly can to get the stuff. One of the really neat things coming about is this new CMON game, Cool Mini or Not. And you know, we had Sir Michael Chennault on the show not too long ago. Was it 3 or 4 weeks ago or so? Talking about their Rising Sun 2 and some of the other stuff they have they're doing on Kickstarter and their fulfillment for other things and just their general philosophy as a game. And then to come to find out they're putting together this A Song of Fire and Ice, a large scale rank and file battle game based on the Game of Thrones books. And I think that's what it is. It's based off the books, not the TV show. And this is, from what we know, we don't know a whole lot. It appears that the miniatures come finally really well detailed, like beautifully sculpted figures, realistic looking figures, and they come assembled. You could as pretty much start playing with them right out of the box, from what I understand.
Oh, yeah. And so far, the only box that we've seen and box art that we've seen is a House Lannister versus House Stark. So, you know, how awesome is that? You know, that's the age old fight there. But all the stuff that, you know, the few things that we've gotten to see so far, and it's so few and so tight lipped still. But it does capture the images and the feel more of the books. And I'm hoping that they hold true to that through a lot of the stuff, because the TV show, as great as it is, it's not all the way the Game of Thrones universe, right? There are some changes.
Wait, is Justin talking about books and reading?
I am probably the most learned dude on the show here.
I rest my case.
No, like these books, I have not read all of them, but I have read most of them. I thoroughly enjoy the show. And it's something that years ago when they started coming out, I enjoyed, but even before I played 40K, I believe, was something that I was already interested in. So to see that, something like this coming to life in a rank and file, you know, think Warhammer Fantasy, like the old way it was played, that's going to be awesome to see some of these, glorious fight scenes and things like that. Like, I hope they have White Walkers. Like, they better have White Walkers, or I'm probably
going to. I mean, probably going to have a series of stuff. From what we can tell in the release or the news release, is that they'll have a Kickstarter. That's their way, starting sometime in third quarter of 2017. And it'll be excited. Available for retail in 2018. But you know that a lot of Kickstarter companies or a lot of Kickstarter campaigns are still allowing you to your retail stores to purchase the bundles, and you can purchase through your retail stores. There's multiple ways to get this. Please support your game stores.
And you know, it's a cool mini or not Kickstarter, so you know you're getting thousands of awesome things with
That's
it.
That's one of the neat things. I go back and forth between whether or not I'm like down with established companies using Kickstarter or not, but there's something to be said about knowing you're going to get your stuff in a timely manner.
Yeah, blindly I click. If I see Cool Mini or Knots logo on something, I blindly click and it's just go. No hesitation whatsoever. They've delivered every time. They're so open about it. Even if there are delays, they let you know. Even in some cases, you get a little extra stuff if there's a major delay, which is really awesome of them. You know, they don't have to do stuff like that. Great company, huge, awesome reputation. They've broken records on Kickstarter time and time again with releases. Just if you're going to go into a Kickstarter, that's a company that I would say without hesitation, go ahead and both feet jump.
That's the trade-off of what Paul just said. He's like, well, you know, how I feel about Kickstarters and proven companies. Well, there's a pro and con to that. And I think that Justin just hit on it, where I know beyond any shadow of a doubt, I know those guys. They are phenomenal human beings. They'll take good care of you. And if it's something that you want, invest in it and you kind of reap the reward tenfold. No question about it. Everything Justin just said is super true. I'm not the world's biggest Game of Thrones fan. I think it's a fun show, and I appreciate it because it has brought nerd culture to the forefront of the pop culture. And so that I think that does a service to everyone who's a fan of kind of obscure nerdy type things. But even though I'm not a big fan of it, I know that it having a rank and file style tabletop war game is wonderful. I remember War of the Ring and watching the Ride of the Rohirrim against the Uruks or all of the, you know, Lord of the Rings is very much the same kind of cult following that Game of Thrones has. And there's something really fun about seeing it played out on a tabletop.
I think when you can put some of your favorite characters or even recreate battles that you know, that were really cool. Anyway, as we get more info, we will pass along. I'll try to have Michael back on the show as more details come out about this, because I see this is something that people are probably going to be interested in. I mean, we know the show is ramping up for the, you know, we got another season coming out in July is when it starts. Yep. And then they'll have the finale the year after for six episodes as we know. Anyway, so the enthusiasm is going to be high, but that's the show's different from the books, and these games are based on the books. Anyway, as we get more info, we'll certainly pass along, and we will talk to some of the makers and brains behind the game as they are comfortable releasing details. I told you back to 40K, the Talons of the Emperor, that box set, one is a lot of gold. It's a lot of gold. And I don't know how I feel about it. I painted a gold rhino once, and I'll be real, I didn't like it. It is the reason why my Inquisition rhinos are not gold. My Grey Knights painted them gold. The custodes paint up. We talked a little bit about how the Sisters of Silence, we weren't so happy with our ability to assemble them. But the custodes, I felt like I could probably put it together blindfold. Sorry, custodes. People get mad if I don't pronounce all the vowels. But I love the way they look. And then but the refreshing, encouraging thing about this is that it seems to indicate that they're going to get 40K plastic transports in whatever formation that we get. I think it's going to be like a mini codex. I don't know, but it looks exciting and gives some hope to some struggling Sisters of Silence users out there.
Yeah. So I think that when I saw the Talons of the Emperor get announced, right, which is what we're talking about, I had just a kind of the full panoply of reactions. I had like the Land Raider in those photos it's not painted well. It certainly wasn't Duncan's doing this, right? Like, it's not the best painting that you've ever
seen.
I
just think that gold on all of those armor plates is difficult to pull off with the amount of gold that they did. But I want to, let me jump in here for just 1 second. This is the first Land Raider that I've actually approved of the Last Cannons being on the back, because I think a Custodes will step out in front of a Last Cannon and not think twice.
Yeah. I think that's a very apt observation. You probably give the Last Cannon a skeezy look for firing.
Anyway, this is all, Codex is coming out.
Well, all fluff aside, as a guy who, to me, and this is just, you know, take my list crafting acumen for what it's worth. I don't believe if you're, especially in a singles tournament, you know, team tournaments are a little different, but if you're in a singles tournament and you're playing a Imperial force, if you yourself are not relying on psychic powers, to me, Sisters of Silence are an auto include. I think it's a no-brainer that you bring at least 75 points worth of Sisters of Silence.
Well, yeah, we were talking about that. With them and the swords, the two flamers, you're looking at 79 points.
Yes, so it's sub 80 points for just an incredible value what you get in terms of anti-psyker defense. Huge bubble of defense against your opponent's psykers. And then even if your opponent doesn't have any psykers, they're still really powerful in and of themselves. You know, it's one of those things like, oh yeah, I've got strength 4, AP 2 close combat weapons that swing at initiative 5, right? Like, no one's sticking their nose up in the air at that. They're just really, really strong in and of themselves. So I think Sisters of Silence are tremendous value in the 40K competitive specter. The one knock against them is that they're foot slogging all the time. And so while I was kind of revolted by the paint job and the aesthetic of this Talons release, I was encouraged and kind of like, whoa, this is exciting. Because it looked like, you know, here's a Land Raider and a Rhino for your Custodes and your Sisters of Silence. And the strong implication there, and again, we don't have the rules yet, but the strong implication there is that you can put your Sisters in a Rhino. And if that's the case, man, you just took an incredibly powerful and incredibly useful unit and then just upped its viability.
You know, the seats in there are more comfortable.
They probably are. I got cushions and red velvet. Yeah, yeah. If anyone's unfamiliar, the Sisters of Silence have the aura that the Calexis Assassin does. It removes psyche powers. It's more difficult to harness warp charge when you're around them. And what they essentially do is turn off a powered up Death Star. They make it difficult for beings like Magnus or Fate Weaver to cast psyche powers. And anyway, really good. So this is not I don't want to necessarily talk about the virtues of a Calexis versus the Sisters of Silence, but it was impossible before to even think about putting them in any kind of transport. Same with the Calexis. And the Calexis is what? He's 100 and,
45,
something like that, points already. So he's pretty much double the cost of 5 Sisters models. Now, the Calexis got a lot going for it, but the Sisters of Silence have a lot going for them too, simply for the area they can cover on the table, because even every single one of the models has the rules.
Yeah, so that's the real crux of it. I mean, you're looking at 5 models on 32mm bases when spread out at max coherency, cover 12 inches left to right. And then it's anything within 12 inches of a single model in this unit basically has the Calexis turn off your powers thing. So from left to right, you have 36 inches of no psychic powers from your opponent. And it turns off all their blessings. And then, and just as importantly, they cannot be targeted at all. Like, full stop. You may not target them with witchfire attacks or maledictions, which means, you know, if you're in large part with demon armies, especially, they have basically no shooting except for witchfires and maledictions. And so if I've got a Sisters of Silence unit or two in my build, they literally need to get either A, get into close combat. That's really the only way you can do damage to them. So they're tremendous value, tremendous, tremendous value. And the Rhino allows you to kind of spring the trap, if you will.
And this is theoretical. This is theoretical because we don't know. I mean, we can assume that the land is for the Custodes. The Rhino is going to be for the Sisters. We can just assume.
Correct. Right. So, but, you know, in a theoretical sense, if, you know, it's not a stretch. It's kind of like the supposition is that the Rhino is going to be for the Sisters. And if that's the case, you're going to be able to move 6, deploy 6, and then have an effective anti-psychic range of another 12 inches. So you basically have this giant 24-inch, I can jump my Sisters out at you and turn off all your psychic powers kind of bubble from a 35-point Rhino.
And a lot of lists, and you can plan on, you can really bank on this idea, if this pans out to be true, of you just need one turn of shutting off the enemy's psychic powers.
That's hugely important to recognize, right? I don't need 3 turns of turning your psychic powers off. I need 1 turn of turning off your veil or your invis off your Death Star. And then my Imperial, like, so for example, if you've got an Imperial Guard gun line, right? And I'm going up against a Death Star. Well, normally that's almost an auto lose for the Imperial Guard because I can't do any damage to the Death Star because they've got
invis. You're banking on volume of dice, and then those volume of dice don't even hit, and then you have fewer to get wounds, and then they're rerolling their saves, and so it's just you're essentially rolling dice for 30 minutes to make
for no reason,
wound. Right?
Exactly. So
that's assuming there is no lookouts are going on.
Exactly. So the shenanigans on you know lots of dice rolls for very very marginal or negligible impact. But if you've got those Sisters in there, they move, they jump out, they turn off that Death Star psychic powers. Well, now we're cooking with gas, right? Because you can just bombs away and do real damage with barrage weapons or whatever else. And this is kind of like a, you know, pull a rabbit out of that.
Well,
like,
let's just break it down to math. You're hitting 300% more often than you were if they didn't exist, if the Sisters weren't there.
Exactly. In this situation. Exactly right. And so, you know, you can kind of take that, whether you take it from a statistical approach or just take it from kind of a confidence boost in
just
terms
feels
of like
better.
It just feels better. I now have a fighting chance against Death Stars or and you know, my preference for the Sisters of Silence and why I think they're super valuable is against Magnus, right? And the Rahati, which I think that the Magnus Rahati psychic kind of that list, it to me is a tremendous. It leaves a bad taste in your mouth. It's very much like a bark Star. It's unengageable. It's not you're not really playing Warhammer 40K against your opponent if they've got Magnus and the Rahati, because it's like I can't do any damage to them. They're just flying around doing what they do, summoning stuff, blah blah blah. It's a feel bad experience for you if you're playing against it. And so as tasteless as that list is, if you have the Sisters of Silence, you can at least zone those guys out, right? Because they can't shoot at your Sisters. They have to land and assault them if they want to do any damage to the Sisters. And so you can create huge bubbles where the Demon Princes and Magnus are basically useless. And as far as like confidence boost and game planning, that's a huge advantage.
And even if you've got them positioned, they may be in a place that makes it very difficult for them to harness the warp charge to do anything to the units that even aren't them, the ones that you could even target. They're still needing some worse rolls.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. So anyway, it's good. It's really neat that we have the potential to make them even more effective. You know, I'm taking a Castellan's list that's just for in the singles competition coming up, and because of the way the models that I'm using in the team event, I don't want to say limited my options. I wanted to not travel with 3 armies or whatever. It turned out I had about 80 points left over, and the Sisters of Silence just fit right in.
Yeah, exactly. Whether it's like, oh man, I got 80 points left. What am I going to do with it?
Yeah, or if it's melted bombs, or I get to beat demons alive.
Exactly right. It's everyone gets melted bombs, or I can totally stagnate Magnus Like, let's do this thing. So,
but you're really excited to see these this formation coming out. We didn't expect it, especially coming on the back of Inferno. Now, because I really expected to see more of like 40K legal Inferno stuff, but I think this is even bigger telegraph saying that they want 30K to start having its own kind of unique feel to it.
Well, you know, speaking as a big 30K fan, I will be 100% honest and tell you that I do not like that this has come out this early before those ranges have been flushed out. And the fact that it's going to omit a lot of the Forge World stuff that has already come out, which I feel like is a must. You know, it's a companion to these models. It's what fleshes those out as forces in 30K. You know, a Land Raider and a Rhino just are very, I feel very nonplussed.
Be the 30K side. The 30K side is going to be the sandworm and the cool tanks for the custodes. That's all there. That's going to
And the metal chocobos for the sisters and all of that
awesome stuff there. And then 40K is going to be 40. I mean, I don't know if it's going to be. I mean, I'm not. We have again no insight. It just seems like there's going to be more of a feel to them from the 40K side, and then a feel to them for the 30K side that will be distinct. And I'm cool with that.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that's inappropriate either, because, you know, 10,000 years, it's a long time. You expect, especially with the deterioration of the Imperium, you expect things to be lost. You know, that's kind of 40K's shtick is, oh, everything was better in the past. You see that in a lot of fiction, actually. But still, I look at the Contemptor Dreadnought model, that's the plastic one that comes, you know, they came in the Betrayal of Cal set. And then I look at the Forge World Dreadnought. And, well, both Forge World Contemptor Dreadnoughts for the Custodes. And I think, man, you really let yourself go, didn't you?
That model is insane. It is beautiful beyond reproach.
That is begging to be converted into Furioso Librarians. The Halberd one? Oh, my gosh. It's going to happen.
Somebody get somebody on that right now. Oh, man.
I'm encouraged.
Yeah, I'm encouraged to see what's coming down the pipe with all this stuff. Again, there's just no end to it, it seems. I mean, this is to keep up with this pace. I mean, it's making me sweat. I can only imagine how the company is feeling.
Right?
Anyway, it's good for us, though.
Yeah, no complaints here in that respect.
Talking about metallics, I want to lead that into the finishing move segment here. Now, this is going to be a little bit out there. This is going to sound... I actually want to talk about alchemy. That's what I want to talk about. I want to talk about turning base metals into something fantastic. Can I do that?
Okay.
I'm intrigued.
I will light a few candles and draw some circles on the...
You know I don't like science, so let's do this thing.
Let's do it. All right. Well, the finishing move segment is sponsored by Frontline Gaming. They've got the new mats coming out. You know, we talked about them. We had a recent on the show last week talking about how the awesome like terrain they have planned around it. And if you haven't even checked out what they call their standard ITC terrain, I really encourage you to do so. It goes together well. It looks good. It performs its function on the tabletop. And now you're going to get a series of terrain themed on the mats. It's so cool when you can put themed terrain on your awesome mats, and it really doesn't impress your friends. I think that's the best way to put it.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, the Robot City mats in particular, when I first was unboxing those while I was helping them unpack at the LVO, I was like, oh my gosh, this is so cool. And then I saw the terrain for it, and I was like, and it's got matching terrain all at the same time. I was floored.
Very fancy. Great. Yeah, so go to frontlinegaming.org. That's where they've got their podcast, Signals of the Frontline, which we're big fans of. Anyway, anytime we can pass along love to another great show, happy to do so. These guys happen to have a great product, which we endorse as well. Please check them out. So back to the fantastic. Some time ago, I was very proud of my original Dante figure. You guys have heard me talk about this before. When I sat down, I painted Dante, the Eldar Avatar, and Jayne Zarr all in the same day 100 years ago. It might have been 150 years ago, when those models were brand new. And I was incredibly proud of them. It was the best painting I did at that point, and was probably my best painting for several years after that. It's like just channeled all my energy into that. Well, after the Sanguinary Guard came out, and then, you know, I wanted to do a new Dante, but I didn't necessarily want to disrupt my old Dante, but I wanted to have Angel Wings jump pack. So what did I do? I went and got a new Dante and painted him. Now, the model is still great, but he's shorter. So, of course, built up the base. And anyway, I wanted to make it kind of a spectacle, but I didn't want to disrupt what I'd done originally that I was so proud of. I was looking around for ideas on how to make him look unique and special in the army to kind of offset his stature, his shortness compared to the Sanguinary Guard. Because even when you put a Sanguinary Guard near a normal modern Marine, their legs are still a little bit longer, and they're a little bit bigger Marines than the other ones.
Yeah, they definitely have a little edge to them, for sure.
No doubt. Anything that's come out in the last, I would say, 5 years, basically anything that's come out since 2012 is noticeably larger than what came out previous to that.
Yeah, and if you put a modern Marine chest on Sanguinary Guard legs, it still looks a little squat. Like they're just like a fraction, to me anyway, they look just like a small fraction larger than other comparable modern release Marines. And so obviously Dante, the skull from a long time ago, on that scale. So I want him to look unique and special and whatever. So looking around for ideas, and a buddy of mine told me, he's like, well, what I did was I painted my Dante silver, and then I'd used about 47 coats of sepia on him to give him a gold hue.
Mm.
And I'm exaggerating the number, but I wanted to put that out. It's a lot of coats of wash, and it gave him an antique gold look, different than the antique gold from even. I use some Vallejo colors for the gold, and for my golds, I think the original burnished gold from Games Workshop is my favorite gold. It has now been replaced by Retributor Armor. It's the closest thing to it in the modern day, anyway. But at the time, you know, the golds weren't the same. Old gold from Vallejo is still a little bit different. And the Sanguinary Guard I used with that gold. But I wanted Dante again to look awesome and unique. So I tried this technique where, based on a bright silver. That was the kind of the crux of it. It was a bright silver. I don't remember the exact name of the silver. But it would be like a mithril silver. Or is it a Stormhost now?
Oh, I think Stormhost Silver is the new one, but it was Runefang Steel for a while, too.
Okay.
Which I think is still a color.
Yeah, Runefang is the one that I have, yeah.
Whatever that brightest silver was is what I did. And then I just started layering on. And this is, again, our man Duncan preaches this, but it's very, very thin layers until you get the color that you want. So started with one kind of heavy one, but you don't want the wash to pool up. That's the critical thing here, is because there's lots of details in these models. And when you're doing a single coat, or maybe even a coat and a half, or a coat and then a half coat, or whatever, you know, you don't have to be quite as careful with it. At least I'm not quite as careful with it, but you don't have to be quite as careful with it. But when you're doing what is going to turn into be many coats to get a completely different color, you've got to be super careful. So with that said, about maybe third or fourth coat, you start to see the metal turn a different shade. You can't even tell that this was previously a silver color.
Mm.
So after trying that, this is a long-winded way of saying that, after trying that, you can actually do this with different colors. So we've seen this on the tutorials with power weapons, where you paint the weapon silver and then you go in with a bluish color or a green color or a red color or whatever. It is a way that you can get a remarkably different effect that may stand out from the rest of your army to give your character models or your sergeants a truly unique color. Because no one else is going to have it. They're not going to have the same color that you have because you're using this staggered layered effect of the washes.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big fan of putting some extra attention or some unique details into sergeants, even though they're not as, you know, shiny or beautiful per se. Rules wise, it's like an Exarch for Aspect Wars with his second wound just kind of shaking his butt in your face before he warp jumps away.
They're not the only ones. They get, I think, Skitarii and other things get two wounds.
But the point being that anything you can do to make that look more distinct, especially if you're looking at it from a paint score perspective, which is essentially what finishing move is trying to accomplish.
Yeah, just getting that one extra point. Everything we just described, every episode we've ever had is about two extra points.
Yep. It's these little things you can do that maybe take another couple of minutes on the model that you're trying to do them to make it stand out a little bit more. And depending on your format, it will help you. It will help you a lot in your score. So I think that's good.
Oh, well, I mean, you were saying a sergeant. I mean, I fully believe that sometimes you have to have that sergeant hit with his three attacks. And the only way to ensure that is to paint him better.
Yep. Just remember, the first time you play with him, he will die miserably to something really dumb, because that's new model syndrome, and it is a reality. Get it over with. You know, play a fun game with somebody that doesn't matter. Get it out of your system, and then on your next game, he will play like a champion.
Now, obviously, with washes, you do have to be very careful, because they will, you know, they have the tendency to pull, and you don't. And in this instance, we're not. I mean, I was talking about coating the whole figure with Dante, but where the actual subject is you're not coating the whole figure. You're only coating one thing. And this works with like lenses and eyes too. The wash over another color can give you a radically different effect, and that effect can be unique depending on how you apply you specifically. The paint, it is not paint, the wash. So that's what
the pigment.
I'm sure if Adam were here, he'd be telling us how all these words don't actually mean what we think they do. And I agree. We're using the words that are comfortable to us. But you get where I'm talking about. You're taking that.
We're speaking the language of the people.
Yeah. You're taking that pot of blue ink or wash or whatever, the Gilliman blue, the Gilligan blue, the reboot gullible.
You know? Yes. Oh, man.
All that. You're taking that, and then you're putting it some. And then with, you know, we talked about, especially where we were talking about the warp gate, not the warp gates, the realm gates for Sigmar and stuff, how to get that glowy effect. This, you can do the same thing on these power weapons, or even a whole model or boot, or maybe something has got a mailed gauntlet that you want to stand out and not be. You want to say it's this, it's either a shiny brand new, or maybe it's an ancient, depending on the color that you use, but you want to have a different effect.
And can we have a moment of silence real quick for the Dead Man's Hand and Captain Tycho?
Tycho's mask would be another awesome thing to do a special thing on. You know, maybe do him up in the Death Company armor, but then you paint his mask like some just really unique looking gold that just pops out amongst all the Sanguinary Guard.
It's interesting because gold is such a tricky color, right? It just is. And like your buddy, you suggested like, you know, just layers and layers of sepia wash over a great silver, which is something, you know, I don't know who that guy is, but like, absolutely, I'm going to do that this week. Just to test it out, because that sounds like a really great thing I've never thought of before. It reminds me of, if there are any Archer fans in the world, about the Tyrant of San Marco, where he's just, you know, there's this wonderful painting, and then you just put layers and layers of white over the painting so that nobody can see any of the original painting. Anyway, there's a phenomenal color, and I've talked to Adam about this, as well as Paul, about, I'm a huge Vallejo fan, and I think 90% of my paints are GW paints. I think Citadel paints are wonderful. Like I said, 90% of what I use are Citadel, but there's some Vallejo stuff that is just invaluable. And to me, one of those colors is it's called model color, Vallejo brass. And I know when you think brass, I think when somebody says brass, I think copper. I think something more almost brownish, like a brown metal. But this particular brass color, model color Vallejo brass, is the best gold of all time, in my opinion.
That's a strong endorsement. We have all painted, everyone on the show has painted gold, and yes, probably in some large capacity.
And exactly. I mean, yep. Literally, we're like three. It's like we're like, me, Chris Morgan, and Paul Murphy are like a bad joke. We're like three Blood Angels players walk into a bar, right? Like, it's just terrible. And so, like, yes, we've all painted a ton of gold. Like, I mean, I know that between the three of us, there's what, like 70-something Sanguinary Guard represented in this conversation. And so, to me, this Vallejo brass. Yeah.
All my Grey Knights are gold, too. They're a different shade of gold.
All my Vestroians are trimmed in gold. And when I say gold, every single one of them is trimmed in this brass color. And brass, again, is not what it looks like. It is a very wonderful gold color. And what in my experience, all of the previous golds I'd ever used, especially, and this is, you know, not to knock GW, but the reality is that they have a very just not a lot of pigment. It doesn't cover well.
You got to get that Retributor armor. It will change your life. I mean, not to change the for new stuff. For new stuff, I'm certainly not suggesting going back and repaint all the Sanguinary Guard. But yeah, for new stuff, it's gonna be good. It is good
for sure. I guess I'll have to check it. But I remember the when I got into 40K, I think it was called Auric Armor, was the gold that was in the GW range. And it just didn't cover well enough. I did not like it.
I think I had trouble with that one as well.
I think everyone did. And maybe that's why they changed it.
The old gold, at least. I mean, it was the bright gold. Yes. That I had trouble with.
It was the gold that was listed on the back of the Sanguinary Guard box. And so when I was a child, learning about how to paint, that was what I used because it's like, well, it's on the back of the box. Therefore, that's what I need to use. And it just didn't cover well. And so I got into this Vallejo brass. And so that's one I really, really strongly recommend because I think it covers really well.
No, this is very important conversations. I know I let us off talking about gold, but the subject of the finishing mousse segment here is just about you can easily change the metal color with washes. And I think that is the important takeaway is that you can get these unique effects with washes of your choice. Because, you know, a wash can be a familiar color that you've used on other parts of your army, but maybe not in this way. Can it unify things and help make things stand out? And I think that's the important part here.
Totally agree. So the other thing, too, is never underestimate the power of washing over a color and then retouching that color. And I think that for metallics, that's a big deal. I know that, for example, for all my, I mean, anyone who's seen, check out ForgeNarrative.net. I did a big blog about my Vestroian Imperial Guard army. Anytime all of their shoulder pads, all the trim is in gold. And I would paint that first layer of gold and then wash it. And then I would go retouch the original color to bring that pop back in. It maybe takes, I want to say, 5 minutes per model, especially if you're just doing the metallics, if you're going to rebrighten the metallics. It's not a huge time investment. I mean, you're talking maybe 25 minutes per squad after your wash to go back over with that, whatever your metallic color is, and then brighten back up the spots that you need to brighten up. Not a huge time investment, but it really, really, really is worth your time.
And that's awesome. We'll go ahead and close out, guys. I really appreciate you taking the time with me today. And Andrew, I can't wait to see what you try with this wash technique.
I'm stoked, man.
Good night, everybody.
Cheers.
Night, team.
I see dead people.